This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can listen to our radio show on Pacifica stations nationwide and watch the TV version on Free Speech TV as well as on our website. The conventional wisdom of political organizing is that it is easier to make progressive gains under a Democratic president than under a Republican one. Certainly, under Barack Obama's 8-year tenure, progressives have seen some significant gains on the environment, racial justice, and even a tiny bit on economic justice. There have, of course, been losses. But what is facing us as a country under President-elect Donald Trump is likely to make Obama's presidency look like the good old days. What worked under Obama, and will the same work under Trump? Joining me to help answer that question is Courtney Morris, Assistant Professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University and a correspondent for this program. Welcome back to the show, Courtney.
Thank you, Sonali.
So now that the sort of dust has settled and we are, you know, facing the reality that this is not some surreal nightmare, how to approach the next 4 years becomes the most important question. However, of course, the last 8 years have been no cakewalk. How do you assess Obama's legacy from a progressive perspective, and the ease with which we were able to make change under Obama, given that sadly a lot of Democrats thought Obama's decisions were just fine?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, Obama's legacy will certainly be complex. And, you know, there are many reasonable critiques, I think, to make of Obama, some of which have to do with his own leadership style, some of which have to do with the context in which his administration took place and the various challenges that he faced dealing with a largely Republican Congress that was deeply opposed to many of the basic policy initiatives that he tried to implement under his administration. And some of which had to do, I think, with his real inability, I think, to really take control of the position that he was in, to push forward some of the policy initiatives that he wanted to implement. So, you know, I think in some ways, on one hand, there is, as you said in your introduction, there is a lot to laud about Obama's legacy at this point. I mean, I think just in terms of, you know, his support for equal pay for equal work, he was he did quite a lot of work to really recognize the challenge that climate change poses to the life of the planet, and to the life of, to the future of human beings on this planet. And I think in some ways he tried to take steps to start moving the United States in the right direction towards tackling the issue of climate change, although there was certainly much more that he could have done, in terms of his clean energy plan and you know, various policy initiatives like that. And then there are things that he did in terms of bringing down levels of unemployment, keeping, you know, millions of Americans from just spiraling into economic, decline. And so, you know, he really came into a situation where he had a disaster on his hands. And in some ways, I think he did quite a lot to mitigate a lot of the damage that was left after Bush. That said, you know, there are also other things about Obama's legacy that leave quite a lot to be desired. I mean, we're complaining about the fact that Donald Trump is talking about deporting 3 million immigrants and further extending the existing border wall, you know, but there were 2 million immigrants deported under President Obama, right? And in some ways, while we can say that there have been some changes in terms of racial justice and policing and police abuse and those kinds of issues, on the other hand, you know, the fact that Black Lives Matter as a social movement emerged under the administration of the first Black president, I think really tells us a lot about how much further we have to go to dealing with those issues in substantive ways. So in other words, having a Black man in the White House wasn't nearly enough to deliver the kinds of racial justice and equality that many of us, I think, had hoped for, right, under an Obama administration. So his legacy, I think, is still really in flux, and I think it remains to be seen how his legacy will be evaluated, particularly, in light of all of the changes that will most certainly come under a Trump administration.
And of course, some of the things that the left held or attempted to hold George W. Bush accountable for weren't able to confront Obama in the same way, or maybe they did and didn't get as much media coverage. So Obama was able to continue the wars in Iraq, expand the war in Afghanistan, continue and expand the drone bombings. And in our next story. We're actually going to cover that specifically. But I mean, you know, I would sort of judge his actions by if Bush did what he's doing now, how would the left react? And often, not always, often it felt like he was given a pass by some sector of maybe liberal Americans, those liberal Americans for whom Hillary Clinton's presidency would have been enough, just fine, preserving the status quo was good enough. And now those same Americans are riled up against Trump, which is great. But it feels like whenever we give Democratic administrations a pass on some of the destructive things they do, it sets us back. It sort of undermines our own moral legitimacy when those same things are done by Republican presidents.
Well, I mean, certainly, I think, you know, again, you're absolutely right in the sense that there were a number of issues that Obama could have tackled much more forcefully and didn't. So, you know, we can think about, for example, the 2008 economic crash. So none of the people who were involved, none of the major culprits who were involved in creating that financial crash saw any prosecution by the federal government, right? So none of these major corporations and the men who were at the heads of those corporations were held responsible for their role in creating that collapse. And so, you know, I think that there was quite a lot of frustration with Obama's seeming unwillingness. You know, on one hand, he kind of rode into power on this narrative of change and hope that we could believe in, and then delivered very little on that while he was in office. Again, some of that, I think, we do have to take into consideration that, he was dealing with a Republican Congress that was adamantly opposed to anything that he was trying to do, right? Even things that Republicans agree on, things that they wanted that he extended to them, they were not willing to play ball. So I think that there was a very real, you know, kind of structural constraint that he had to navigate, which I think explains part of the reason why so much of his legacy is tenuous, is because many of the changes he was able to implement were things that he enacted through executive order, moving through kind of the institutional back channels of DC to try to get things done, because he could not get Congress to come along and get on board with what he was trying to do. But certainly, I don't think he did nearly as much as he might have done. And there were certain areas where I think he could have done quite a bit more and just chose not to do it.
Then if you look at his responses to strong social movements, we did see some moves for federal employees in terms of protections, benefits, wages, and we saw his, you know, cancellation of the Keystone XL pipeline with the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Army Corps of Engineers decision, which didn't go far enough. Some say he could have taken steps to make it a much more permanent end to the pipeline, but still it felt like, you know, with a pipeline that's already so far along, he did show some ability to respond to these very, very powerful social movements. The question now is, let's talk about how those same tactics can translate, if at all, under Trump. The Dakota Access Pipeline protesters, the water protectors, faced such incredible militarized police brutality. If that's what they faced under Obama, what might they or other movements face under Trump as they try to protest?
I mean, well, Trump has made it very clear that he doesn't see any reason the Dakota Access Pipeline should not continue. And certainly if his own financial interests dictate how he's going to respond to this issue, you know, he has a stake in this as well. So, I think that we can certainly expect to see more of the same kind of militarized response to popular movements, whether it's around issues of climate change, whether it's around issues of reproductive rights, whether it's around issues of, democratic governance. You know, Trump has made it very clear that his administration's agenda is being dictated by the interests of the ruling class in this country. And so, you know, certainly there was no accountability under Obama for that ruling class. And I think we can certainly expect that there will be even less accountability under a Trump administration. Certainly his cabinet picks don't give us any hope that he's going to take a more progressive direction than Obama. And if anything, I think we really have to be more vigilant, because what we're witnessing now is this onslaught. He is stacking his cabinet with people who are climate deniers, with people who don't believe in reproductive choice, with people who don't believe in strong regulation of the market. So we're going to have a serious battle on our hands, I think, in the next 4 years.
Courtney, how important is it for us to also step up our cultural resistance to this new presidency? And by that, I mean Trump has shown himself to be an extremely thin-skinned, egotistical, and kind of fragile man. I remember under Bush, there were some very creative methods of resistance that just simply didn't apply under Obama. Obama's just presidential, incredibly intellectual, and, you know, just he was not at all an easy target for the left and was not an appropriate target for the left to wage a culture war against him. But Trump seems to be an extremely ripe target for culture wars. And I don't mean the kind of sort of fat-shaming attacks we've seen, or even against his wife, the kind of slut-shaming attacks, but to kind of target him in the way that Alec Baldwin has on Saturday Night Live. How important is that?
Well, you know, I think that there's, you know, one of the things that I've been heartened by in the last few weeks since the election is this ongoing campaign that you see kind of organically emerging across the political spectrum around the country is this refusal to normalize Trump, mm-hmm. right? That we're not going to accept that Trump is a legitimate leader. We're not going to accept that he is someone who really has the best interests of the country in mind. We're not going to accept that his administration has a popular mandate from the people and is empowered by popular democracy in any meaningful way, right? And so I think that those kinds of responses, whether, you know, it was the cast of Hamilton calling out Mike Pence and right. saying, hey, we want to make sure that, you know, that when you're saying you're going to make America great again, that you're not just talking about a small group, of resentful white people, but that you're also talking about immigrants and queer folks and women, that you're talking about all of us. And so I think that those sorts of popular responses are very important. And, you know, as you know, cultural movements are critical parts of the work that social movements do, right? So I think about, the late Black feminist poet and writer, Toni K. Bambara, who says that the job of the artist is to make the revolution irresistible. And I think that that's part of the work that these artists are doing, is that they're pulling lots of people into the conversation and saying, look, you know, we have someone here who is completely incompetent, who is completely self-interested, and who is surrounding himself by the scariest political figures imaginable, right? So we not only have a responsibility to respond politically through, you know, through mobilization and through popular protest, but we also have to create a broader cultural narrative about the illegitimacy of Trump. And I think that that's what people are trying to do in a number of ways all over the country.
And I'm so glad you brought up Hamilton, because their attempt to speak to Mike Pence was, you know, it was characterized by Trump as harassment. But if you actually listen to what they said, it was so respectful. It was so polite. And yet it was very brave. And, you know, they had the chance to speak directly to the future vice president of the country. And they did it very eloquently. And the sort of extreme reaction from Trump to me really revealed that he deserves the moniker of Trumple Thin Skin, as some have called him.
The cast of Hamilton, they were profoundly civil. I mean, yes. That's the irony of it. And they were utterly civil and utterly civil to an administration that has come into power on a discourse of hatred and the ugliest forms of political speech that you can imagine, right? So again, I think that there's a way in which cultural protest allows you to, you know, simultaneously make, important, insightful, trenchant critiques of abuses of power, while also maintaining a kind of moral high ground. And, right. and so, you know, I think it's a critical tool in movements for social change.
Right. And then, of course, while we say that, we must emphasize that political organizing on the ground, grassroots organizing, strengthening communities is going to be so much more important under President Trump than it was even under Obama. And therein lies the challenge, right, Courtney? There are those among us who've been active under all presidents, because injustice, there's always injustice that deserves and needs addressing. And we might be expected to do even more under Trump. Yet there is a huge section of American society that may feel like sharing a story on social media is equivalent to taking action. How do you think the challenge can be met to activate a broader section of American society, because often a small percentage is just a fraction that does all the heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think that this was one of the problems under Obama, right? And in some ways, I think that people were so overwhelmed by the symbolic victory of putting a Black man in the White House that they felt that the country was on the right track, that we were moving beyond, our kind of historic, problems with structural racism, and that we were moving forward. And that clearly was not the case. And so, I think that there was a certain level of complacency, certainly not among people, as you say, people who have been organizing and will continue to organize no matter who is in power. But there was a sense that there was not a need to do that kind of heavy lifting because, the wheels of democracy were turning in such a way that that work was already happening. And with Trump, I think that there are a number of people who have not thought of themselves as engaged political actors beyond participating in the electoral process, and who never thought that they were going to have to get back out into the streets or get into the streets for the first time to defend things that we as a society have taken for granted, right? So I think that, all of a sudden we could take an example like Roe v. Wade, where that seemed for many people to just be, a done deal, that there was no way that that was going to be repealed. And now we face the very real possibility of a Republican Congress that is opposed to abortion rights, a president who's going to be able to appoint the next Supreme Court justice that could potentially tip the scales in the Supreme Court in such a way that abortion rights is now back on the table. And so I think there are a lot of people who are very afraid and who, because they don't come out of an organizing tradition, have no idea what to do. So I've been really encouraged by the work that I've seen people doing around protests with the inauguration, the Women's March on Washington, for example, which is being organized primarily by three women of color, an Arab American woman, an African American woman, and a Latina, have taken the reins of that event and are really issuing a call to U.S. civil society to get involved, that it's not enough to just vote and post and rant on Facebook, but that if you really want to see things change, then bodies need to be out in the streets. And so I think that that's an important first step. But even beyond, gestures like protests and demonstrations, I think more and more people have to begin to get involved in the nuts and bolts of grassroots organizing and figuring out where they're going to insert themselves. So, I think some of the conversations we're seeing about how to revitalize the Democratic Party, if it's possible to kind of hack that infrastructure and use the Democratic Party as a base to really advance a progressive agenda, those kinds of conversations, I think, are hugely important and really where we should be shifting our attention to,
right,
just beyond the symbolic to the substantive.
So a multi-pronged strategy, which is often the answer to any problem. Courtney, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us, as always. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Sonali.
Courtney Morris is an assistant professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University and a correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find our website at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/RUwithSonali.